On this week's episode of That Sound Podcast, we have radio DJ and music connoisseur and guitar collector, Dave Moore from
Today FM, not 2FM, like I said, like a dickhead. thank God he laughed it off. But yeah, we had a great chat with Dave. We delved into a couple of different projects in his life, his early life as a music producer. He went to college and gave it up and started producing music, got into radio. We got an exclusive, I think, Luke, did we?
An exclusive, I think, of a story on Slipknot and what they like outside of heavy metal music.
Yeah, stay tuned for it.
Stay tuned. We also got a very, very interesting story about some of the guitars in Dave's collection.
Yeah.
We got to talk about his collection in depth for all you guitar nerds out there. And one that you may want to stay tuned for is a guitar that he has that has a great backstory. That
very good backstory.
Could have been possibly owned by Kerry King at one stage.
Kerry King, if you're not sure, is the lead guitarist of Slayer, an absolutely massive band back in the day and still in the day. I think Kerry has a new project at the minute.
Yeah, Kerry has a new project
at the minute. Dropped today, I think, actually. But yeah, fabulous stories. Again, enjoy this one. Stay tuned.
Let us know what you think. On this week's episode of That Sound Podcast, we have got the one and only Dave Moore.
Dave is a
very passionate metalhead and a gifted musician. We have the proof.
You're saying all the right things, lads.
Yeah. What is the crack, Dave? It's a pleasure to have you on, and we appreciate you giving up your time to have a wee chat with us.
Listen, thanks very much for asking me. I'm honored. When I heard there was a podcast in the metal sphere, I was like, give us a go of that.
Yeah. Right up our alley.
Absolutely.
So what we like to do is we like to just basically have a conversation. It's just, you know, a bit of crack, see how it goes. Okay, everybody knows who you are, so there's no point in really going back too far. But you're a DJ, obviously.
I'll stop you right
sorry.
There.
Whoa.
There you go. Yeah. These things happen. Slip of the tongue.
Yeah. Today FM for everyone out there.
Blah, 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 blah. Edit.
And, blah, 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 blah.
Today FM DJ.
Listen, at least you're not the guy who we were about 3 months into our when we moved from 98 FM to Today FM. And I'd said 98 FM for 12 years. I don't know how many times an hour. 3 hours, 4 hours a day for 12 years. And I was so panicked about saying 98 FM on Today FM. And I never did it. I was so good. And 3 months in, I went, Dermot and Dave on 2 FM. And they all in the room. And I was like, if I could have taken my eyes out and looked at myself, I was like, where did that come from? Like, yeah. I've never worked for 2FM. I've never thinking about 2FM. And I was just like, that is weird. So I completely forgive you, Gavin, that one.
Yeah,
don't worry.
Yeah, apologies. Right, you go till I get my breath back.
I'm going to be laughing here for a while.
No, we only have an hour.
We do. We do indeed. Well, Dave, it's an absolute pleasure to have you on. Really, really happy to have you on here. And I think it's brilliant that this coincides with you having released a song of your own recently.
You say released. I mean, stuck on, it up on Instagram.
On Instagram.
Yeah.
How did that come about by any chance?
Look, here's the thing. So before I worked in radio, I've always been a musician. And I worked professionally as a musician for about, God, nearly five or six years before I worked on radio. So look, we can go way back in history, but I've always played guitar since I was about 12, been in bands, you know. Some of them were serious, some of them weren't. Some of them were metal, some of them were grunge, but they were always in that, you know, in that sphere. And then I did business studies in Russian, which is standard for every musician, obviously, when they want to go to college, you know what I mean? So I did that, but I had made a deal with my folks that if I was a good boy and did my studies and got my degree, that they would help me in my chosen career path, which was music. And I suppose the usual thing that Irish mammies say to you of, you know, well, make sure you have something to fall back on. So I had a business degree and a Russian language degree. I was like, come on, mom, I have 2 degrees now. Will you help me out? So I went and studied professional musicianship, jazz musicianship out in Black Rock in Dublin. It's the Guilfoyle brothers ran a school out there called New Park Music Centre. Unbelievable jazz musicians, just
absolutely
like,
class. I know Connor.
You know Connor, do you? Yeah, right? Well,
I
know
took
exactly
a couple of lessons with Connor, and he's absolutely incredible.
Yeah.
For so any drum connoisseur out there,
yes, they'll know exactly.
Doesn't know who Connor of the Guilfoyle is. I'm sure there might be a few youngers in the country.
True.
Go check them out.
Yeah, you won't be disappointed. So the lads ran a school, and it was perfect for me because I had come out of 4 years, obviously, of study, even while I was, you know, in bands and doing whatever and having the crack, but it was still study mode. And then if I had just dropped that and gone straight into music, I think I would have felt a little bit lost. But this was a lovely transition where I was studying, but the studying I was doing was music. Do you know what I mean? And that kind of got me in the headspace then to pursue what I wanted to do, which was to be a writer-producer. So I didn't want to be a heavy metaler. You know, I had gone through all that. I didn't want to be in a band. When the band I was in college, we won a battle of the bands and got money to record an album. Well, we got money in the studio. We were quick enough in the studio that we actually got to record an 11-track album. Now, the sound was appalling. The fellow who recorded us obviously didn't know what he was doing. But anyway, that's another day's story. But when I went into a studio, I went, oh no, hang on, this is it. This is what I want to do. I want to be in a studio making music.
Yeah.
I don't care what part of it. I didn't know at that point, did I want to be a tape op, because there used to be people who just ran the tape. You know, a producer, an engineer, a writer. I didn't know. I said, no, studio's where I want to be. So I finished that music year out in Blackrock, and I had job offers because obviously not many people learn to speak Russian and study business at the same time. I remember sitting down with my dad and just going, listen, I'm going to turn down this job offer in Moscow, and I'm going to turn down this job offer in Frankfurt, and I'm going to turn this job offer down in Dublin, and I'm going to work in the petrol station down the road so that I can pay off a bank loan that I've just taken out to buy a home studio. And he was just like, gosh, have I done? Why are you doing this? But in fairness to him, he was also like, look, if it's what you want to do, you know, I'll support you, go and do it. So so here's Double Degree Dave working down the petrol station, you know, charging people for milk and lottery tickets. And what pump are you on there, Mrs.?
I doubt myself, Dave. There's nothing wrong with it.
Yeah, no, I loved it. Like one of the best jobs. In fact, the only real job I've ever had before I worked in radio was that. It was the only other thing. I loved it. But anyway, look, I set up a studio. Now, this is 1997. Okay. So setting up a studio is a lot different than it is today. Today, it's a MacBook, one of these, and away you go. Do you know what I mean? It's some kind of interface for your guitar, and you're pretty much done. It was a lot different in 1997. I remember I spent £2,000 on a sampler, a rack-mounted sampler.
In 1997?
Because it was the thing. That was what you did. You know, it was a Yamaha A3000. It was going to make me, you know, able to make music that I couldn't make without it. Mm-hmm. Now you just, you know, you download or you put the sampler in Logic and just go, I'll use that, and it's free plug-in or whatever, you know. So things were different. So it was a lot of money I spent to get that built up. And then I just basically followed the dream of being a writer-producer for the next 5 years. And it was amazing. And I worked with loads of people and did loads of different projects. And the dream was like, you know, to write for Rihanna or something like that. You know, it was like, it was pop and it was as commercially successful as possible. That was always the aim. I never got there because in 2002, I got distracted by radio, and here I am 22 years later.
Yeah.
It took over, and all of a sudden I realized there was something else I loved and something else that I could do for a living. So the music has always been there. Like, it's always been something I've followed. So what happened? To get back to the track, sorry for the long history lesson there. But
That's absolutely great to hear.
You worked on a show on Netflix too, wasn't it?
Yeah, I've done loads, like I film and TV. I've done lots of stuff like that. Netflix is great because a friend
Stay
of mine
close, wasn't it?
Is which?
Stay Close, was that the
Stay
show?
Close, because, Close, yeah. So the director of Stay Close is my best mate, Dan O'Hara, and nepotism pays off. If you know someone, they might get you a gig. Yeah. But basically, while I did business in Russian, he did, so we were in school together, met him when I was 12. We both went to school together, both went to the same, we both went to Trinity, same course, but I did business in Russian, he did business in German. When I left to study music, he left to study film. And so we literally kind of mirrored our career paths, just in different, you know, different places, but mirror the same thing. And he's now a huge deal in drama in the UK and internationally. And he's got a new show coming out called Red King. which is going to be out very soon. So keep an eye out for that. But he was doing Stay Close. And Dan, look, when you operate the level he operates at, like I've done loads of music for him over the years, but that was when he was doing smaller projects. And he rang me one day and he went, it was a Friday night, actually. It was Friday evening, say about 4 o'clock. And I was going to coach my daughter's football team. And I was kind of going out getting ready for that. And he went, yeah, can you just grab me for a sec? I was like, yeah, what's crack? And he goes, I need, you know, La La Land. And I was like, the movie? He's like, yeah. He goes, I need a La La Land version of Radiohead's Creep.
Yeah.
And I was like, hey, that sounds interesting. Sounds like something. It's not all to do, but that's the kind of thing I used to. When somebody wanted something that sounded like something else, okay, they knew Dave Moore was the guy to go to in the ad agency world and the TV world and whatever. You know, if you wanted the best quality recorded, unbelievably produced original piece of music, you didn't come to me. You know, I was a lower level than that. Wasn't quite that talented. But in terms of making something sound like something else, and in terms of getting a project done and quickly, I was your guy. So Dan knew that anyway. So he rang me and asked that. And I said, yeah, sounds great. When do you need it for? Monday.
Oh.
Dan, it's Friday night. I've just worked for a week. I'm about to coach football and then fall asleep on the couch. Mm-hmm. I know, I'm really sorry, but the reason I'm asking is because the composer that, again, would have been like 10 levels above me has got so much on that he can't do this in time. So, and the reason we need it Monday is because that's to give it to the two cast members and the dance teacher who are rehearsing this dance they're going to do, and we're shooting it on Tuesday. There was no wiggle room. So I was like, okay, fine. How am I going to do this? So I sat down, and the first thing I did was obviously listen to Creep a million times, figure out what key it's in, figure out, you know, okay, if I'm going to sing it and it's a La La Land style, is it in staying the same key? Or am I going to a different key? And then Dan ran me back and went, by the way, I want a duet with a female. And I was like, you're just making this easier by the minute, Dan. Yeah, thanks. Yeah. So I basically thought about how can I turn this around in the time I need to make it good enough to be on a Netflix show, okay? Because that's a different request than, can you do music for, you know, my mate's student film? You know, that's different. This is going on Netflix. So then they called in favors. So I went, hang on a sec. So I'm really good friends with Brezzy. Brezzy co-owns a studio inside in Dublin called Camden Studios. And Camden Recording Studios are just absolutely amazing. But Keane, who co-owns it with Brezzy, is probably the Guilfoyles are the best bass and drum players in jazz. Keane might be the best piano player in Ireland, right? So I said to myself, well, if I do a terrible piano arrangement of this with the basic chords blocked out and tell Keane to do one pass, just literally, and it was only about 90 seconds long. Mm-hmm. Keane, here are the chords, here's the chord chart, just do that. And he played the most magnificent piano piece you've heard. Because if you go and watch the beginning of episode 3 of Stay Close, when two people are disposing of a body up near a big bridge, it's a really weird scene. But if you listen to the piano, like, that's not me. That's Keen just absolutely killing it.
Yeah.
And then when I was talking to Brezzy about getting Keen to do it, I realized, oh, hang on, Louise Carroll, who is his girlfriend, the bass player and vocalist in the Blizzards, I was like, would Louise sing this thing? And he's like, I'll ask her, I'm sure she would. She said yes. So then again, I just sent her the terrible kind of comped piano I had. She sang beautifully over that. Then I came in, I sang my parts, did some harmonies, got the piano line back from Key and had programmed up the drums and the double bass and whatever, and then set about actually mixing the thing, getting it sounding good. And then I called in another favor with a guy called Aidan Cunningham, who I hope you guys know. He used to be in probably one of the best metal bands this country's ever produced called Murdoch. It was unbelievable metal band, these lads. It was three lads. It was Aidan's guitar and vocals, Ronan Owen is drums, again, one of the best drummers around, and Rob Powderly, who's in Hero and Error, used to play bass with them. But they're just, honestly, search out Murdoch. Dead Lung is an album that will just blow your mind. But anyway, Aidan's now one of the best mixers and mastering engineers in the world. So he was in New York at the time. So I emailed him and went, if I send you a poorly mixed La La Land, can you master it for me just really quickly? So I did my best with the mix. In fairness, he didn't touch the mix. He said the mix was great, was fine. But he just mastered it for me. And again, that elevated it again up to a level. Sent it across to Dan on Sunday night. And obviously he and the good people at the production company who were making the show for Netflix were very impressed. So much so that on Tuesday, they rang me and asked me to do a second piece of music, which is actually in episode 8. Don't want to spoil anything, but there's a big I'll call it a party at the end of episode 8. It's been out for a while. Probably won't spoil it. But in that, there's a band playing. It's Paloma Faith. It's her full band. Now, she's not singing, but it's her full band who are performing. But they're performing. That's actually me. I'm playing all the instruments. Singers sang it live on top of the instrumental I sent them. So it just, that stuff just kind of happens, you know what I mean? And so I've always had my finger in it. I've always, like, every now and again, something crops up. And, you know, the Irish Cancer Society asked me to do the music for Daffodil Day 1 year, and they still use it every now and again. The piece of music I wrote, it was an orchestral piece, whatever. So you just kind of, you never know. Like, these projects, you just kind of pop up again and you go, oh, that's my music. Oh, yeah, I remember that, yeah.
And do you enjoy doing them projects? Like, is it kind of like stress relief or nearly? Like, it's a kind of a...
That's what music is for me in general, Gavin.
Yes,
like,
yes.
You know, whether it's listening to it or whether it's sitting down playing it.
Absolutely, yeah.
You know, it
therapy.
Total therapy, and particularly the bass. Actually, I'm a guitar player, but like one of my favorite artists in the world is Sting, and I have a Sting bass playlist, which is just a collection of his songs, probably about 3 hours of his music, very carefully selected of his catalog. And it's all Police, it's all Sting, no Police.
Oh, okay.
Like, and it's funny because Dermot, who I used to do the show with, the opposite, he can't stand Sting since he left the Police and loves the Police, and I'm the opposite. I'm like, Police, yeah, whatever, not interested. Sting solo, that's my favorite music. Like, so I have this playlist. I put in my Boss Wazza Air, kind of, you know, which I don't know if you know, but they're like it's you can play along with the music. It's like an iRig, but it's just all contained in Bluetooth headphones. Turn the lights out, literally almost lie down, close my eyes, and 3 hours is gone like that. It's just, I don't know, maybe there's something about bass, and don't trust me, Sting is an unbelievable bass player, but the songs I've chosen are not, I don't need my eyes open. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, you know,
I'm not like, you know, I'm not Cliff Burton, like, you know, double fingering like a million miles an hour. It's good. There's some of them are fast and some of them require a little bit of concentration, but, you know, you can just kind of completely zone out. And if I'm stressed at all, my missus will say to me, go upstairs and play your bass. And I'm like, thank you. And that is for me,
that's incredible.
It's such an amazing thing. And if you can find something like that you love doing.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
That's press release. It's amazing.
If it's listening or playing, it really does just lower everything. It just
totally
such a stress reliever. Such a stress reliever. Your podcast with Neil Delamere is flying.
Sure is flying. It's wild, that one.
I enjoyed the last episode.
Thank you very much for listening, man. I love when I hear people listen to it because
I was driving over to Sligo and I was listening to it and. The whole nut, the dairy McCall.
he blindsided me with that, and I was like, wait a minute, of all of the things to choose, of all of the bars you could have chosen, a whole nut. Like,
I actually went home and asked my wife and her sister, I'm like, do you like that? No, why would I eat them? I'm like, I actually eat them.
Well, there you go. So obviously we should explain, if people haven't listened, I'm sure lots of your listeners haven't listened to our podcast, but it was just a conversation about how old you need to be to enjoy a whole nut, and I was suggesting it's a middle-aged pursuit. It's one of those things that, like, 45 plus, knock yourself out. Nobody under 45 eats whole nuts, but apparently Gavin does.
Yeah, it was very funny. It was very funny.
That reminds me now of my grandfather's favourite chocolate was either crisp or fruit and nut or whole nut.
He wasn't
under 45.
No, he definitely wasn't.
Yeah, I really enjoy it, and people should check it out. It's a very good podcast there. Why would you tell me that? It's very, very enjoyable. It's actually educational and comedic, I must say.
Well, that was the aim. Like, we sat down, Neil and fairness to him, we've been good friends for almost as long as I've been in radio. Now, we haven't hung out a whole lot, but
even though he's a Liverpool fan,
I can forgive. I've got a few of them in my life. There's nothing you can really do, I suppose. Yeah.
At least he ponied up after Sunday, Dave.
He did. Because I mean, I never bet on football with anyone.
Yeah,
you know, I don't bet anything, but I certainly wouldn't bet on football because God knows mad stuff can happen. Nothing's guaranteed, particularly with this United team.
Yeah, we'll get there. We'll get there with that dilemma.
Don't mention the war.
and he texted me. Literally, I was putting my phone on Do Not Disturb because I knew the Scousers would be out in force, especially if they went 1-0 up. So I was like, I'm not dealing with this. So I swiped down, was about to hit thing, and just as I did it, a message came in. Do you want to have a bet in the game? And I was like, no. And he goes, go on, 20 quid. And I was like, all right, fine. And then... Do Not Disturb, whatever. Didn't hear another word from him until after about almost 2 or 3 hours after the final whistle. So, no, he did. He paid up his 20 quid. But, we always wanted to work together. And I don't like TV in the slightest. I have no interest in it. There's barely anything I would like to do in the world of television. Neil loves it, and he's always trying to get me on telly and do this project with me, do that one, I'm doing this, you be mad. I'm like, no, not interested. So eventually he sat down with me and he was like, look, what would you do? I was like, oh, dude, it's loads of things to do. What do you want to do? And he goes, would you write telly? And I was like, absolutely, like, love it. I'd write a sitcom tomorrow. And he went, right, that's what we're doing. So we sat down, we wrote this sitcom called Pumped, like a pilot episode. And it was about two lads who owned a gym. And it was it was one of the most fun experiences I've had, honestly. Like, to create something out of nothing like that, the way you do with music, but to create, you know, funny scenarios and make each other laugh our holes off. Like, it was amazing. And that actually got picked up by a production company in the UK. We got a bit of money for writing it. Now, it never went anything beyond that, because I suppose you have to, the production company then has to shop it to networks and get somebody to eventually greenlight it. So that didn't happen. But that was fine. It said to us that there's something there, you know, between the two of us. We work well together. So after that, we kind of kept looking at projects, going, what we do, we write something else. And then, I don't know, I think it was him said, what about a podcast? And I'd had this idea of a fact-based podcast that was funny. That was basically my idea. It was like, because I've been doing Dave's World on the radio show for 20 years, which is effectively me trying to tell Dermot facts, but him not being interested in it, which was funny in itself. But I figured maybe if I could just do so with someone who loved facts as much as I do, but if we could make it fun on top of that. So he thought it was a great show. So we just very quickly put it together.
It's very good.
Put it out with, you know, absolutely, as all podcasts start, you know yourself, start with zero listeners and see what happens. It's rocked. We're on season six now. We're halfway through season six, and we do kind of 10 to 12 episodes a season. So, and they're all evergreen. That's the other thing about our podcast, is like, much like your own, like, you're just talking to someone or you're figuring something out. So it's not like, well, if you listen this week, it's gone. It's not like a football podcast or a current affairs podcast. Like, you can go back, pick any episode at any point, and yes, hopefully you will learn something and have a bit of crack as well.
Yeah, so. No, definitely. Let's get to the guitars.
Yes,
let's get to that for sure.
Tell us about your collection, Dave.
Oh, my collection. It's actually, would you believe, it's usually I'm so, you know, super passionate about my collection, and I still am, don't get me wrong, but the last maybe 6 months, things have changed for me. The studio I built, when I say built, it was a bedroom in my parents' house, right? But I built it as a studio, if you know what I mean. And my patient parents, that's still there, because obviously all the kids moved out and they didn't need this bedroom. And I kept saying to them, no, I'll leave it there. I might do a project now and again. And I've done nothing. But now it is just like this. It's like the back of X Music or the back of Music Maker. It's like, it's just racks and racks and racks of guitars, right? Nice. Which is silly, because I don't live in that house. Now, it's not far from where I live, and I can nip up anytime I need, and I can pick up whatever guitar I want, and all my cases for my guitars are there and whatever. But like in this house here, like I must have, like, I must have 40 guitars in the house. Like, my wife is so patient, right? So basically, so we sleep in the converted attic. So we sleep on it's on the third floor. Sounds like we're posh. Trust me, we're not. We just have a converted attic. But there's enough. It's not like a stair, and it's a real staircase that the last people who owned the house put in. And I just looked at all this blank wall space. You couldn't put anything on because it's so high and whatever. And I went to my missus, can I hang a few guitars there? And she was like, yeah, a few. I think she thought I meant three. So I literally put up, I think the first weekend, I had 18 guitars hanging. Oh. And it's, when you walk up the stairs, it's just like a guitar shop. Like, and you turn around and there's more, and it keeps going.
It's just,
and
like, again, Jimmy's when you walk in the first corridor.
Honestly, that's what it's like. Now, she's very patient, as I said, and she doesn't mind them hanging up there at all. And then, if I just lift this up, and I realize we're a podcast and it's visual for you two and probably nobody else, but there's a 9 rack there in the front room. Nice. And they're all Ibanez. Yeah, every single one.
A lot of nice gems there.
There's one gem, yeah. There's a Universe. There's an Apex, which is Monkey from Korn's guitar, and then some more Gs. And the thing is, it's very specifically, she chose...
I love the color.
Guitars go there, because my collection isn't just Ibanez, but she wanted colors that complemented the colors of the sitting room, which is fair. And she also, she didn't want any red, for example. There's a shocking pink, and there's a road flare, but there's no red. So I had a couple of red, and she was like, nope, get rid of them, get them out. I was like, okay, fair enough. And then she also wanted all Ibanez because all the headstocks are the same.
Yes.
So they look, you know, it looks like there's some kind of decisions been made in there, whatever. So all I got of 9 there in acoustic, and of course, that's 10 in this room alone. Oh. And then 30 odd, as I said, going up the stairs. But then in my mom's house, and you're like, there's another, I don't know, another, there's at least another 40. So I'm like, why have I got 80 guitars? Now, don't get me wrong. Nice. I'm so proud of them. I love every single one of them. Yeah. And I have a reason why I bought every one. And like, they're not 85 grand. You know, Les Pauls, they're guitars I bought for 100 quid and 200 quid and some I got for free. And, you know, I like doing guitars up, I like changing things around. Like that gem that's there is a shocking pink gem with the pyramid fretboard. So it should be about 9 grand. It's not. It's an Ibanez 750 that a guy in, I think he's in Denmark, took apart, took the fretboard off, put a new fretboard on, did an unbelievable paint job, cut the monkey grip and the claw perfectly. Like, and I got that for silly money. Whereas if I wouldn't keep a 9 grand gem sitting in the front room when my kids are bringing all their mates in. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I'll keep the one that's less than 10% of that price sitting there because it's fine. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So the numbers are kind of insane. And so that's what I mean. In the last little, like 6 months or so, things have changed. What I've started to do is I actually started to sell. And yeah, I'm just shifting little bits. It's not, there's not much, like, I mean, to be honest with you, find the time to photograph, research, get all the details and pick a price and put them up on adverts and then put them up on Reverb, whatever. It takes a bit of work, as anyone who sells it knows. So I got the first batch up. I sold 9, I think, in the last kind of 6 months or so. And I'll keep going because I've gotten to that point in the collection that I know the ones I really want. Do you know what I mean? I know the ones I really want to keep and I'll keep them. And the rest are part of the collection now, but I won't be upset if I let them go and they get a good home somewhere, you know?
And I heard a good story about, was it the first guitar you bought when you were working in the airport?
Oh, yes. Yes, that is a good story.
That is a good story.
We should start the story by saying, I have no proof that this is true, but I have little breadcrumbs along the way that this is true.
Right? So, I have an inkling that this could be very true.
Okay,
and
right.
That's off the back of, is it the Seasons in the Abyss video or Set the Heaven video?
Yeah, Seasons in the Abyss.
I am an ESP nut fanatic,
right,
and I am kicking myself with some of the guitars I've missed in the past, especially when I was 12, 13, 14, and for anyone that knows, during the recession in Ireland, there was some really nice guitars going at very short money, and that
if we could go back and buy them, we would
be very wealthy men today. One of them being a Kerry King Crackle V.
And now, I don't own a Kerry King Crackle V, and it's not an ESP I own, right?
Yeah. One of them, I think it sold on adverts back in the day for 3 grand. Was it?
You're joking.
Yeah, and I know they go for south of 18, 20 at the
minute. Absolutely. They're huge money.
That was the one, Dave, after, say, the red and black that was done for Kerry himself. And I know RGV Guitars in Denmark, or not in Denmark, in the Netherlands. He had one of the red and black ones that's similar paint job to your Haymore. So
wow.
I would be very, very, not certain, but confident that it's around that period and the paint job matches up. So, you know, put two and two together.
The paint job matches up, the pickups match up, the trem match up, and the trem is the really telltale thing. So Kerry and Jeff have always used Kaler trems. And Kerry still uses Kaler. So no matter what guitar company he's with, he will only put a Kaler trem in it. He won't put a Floyd Rose in. He won't put a fixed bridge. It's all Kaler trems. So I was going in at age 16. I had 600 pounds, Irish pounds, and I needed to buy a guitar and an amp. And there was an orange Charvel, or was it a Charvette? It might have been a Charvette, I think. Super Strat kind of thing, orange shark tooth inlays, gorgeous guitar. I was loving that. And I think it was a Krait G60 amp. And I was buying both of those things 400 for the guitar, 200 for the amp, and then I was joined this band because I had a guitar and an amp. And before this, I had a guitar, but I had a 10-watt amp. They wouldn't let me in the band with the 10-watt amp, which is fair enough. So I saved all the money working the airport, as you said, Gab, yeah, and kept going in every week going, oh, I'll have my money now in a month, I have money in 4 weeks, I have money in 3 weeks, whatever. And obviously the lads in the shop were sick of us coming in every week and tire kicking effectively because we didn't have the money yet to buy something, but stuff. So guitar shops have that all the time. But eventually I went in with the roll of 20 pound notes. And I mean, I looked like a proper like gangster because they were wrapped. They weren't going to fit in a wallet. Like there were so many of them. And the easiest way to stack them was to roll them and put an elastic band over them. So I walked in and the guy who worked in the shop was a kind of an acquaintance. He lived in Portmarnock as well. I knew him. So I plonked it down comedically on the desk and went, I'm here for my guitar and my amp. And he went, okay, cool. So he started getting the guitar down off the wall, wrapping it up, getting the box for it or whatever. And there was this hammer hanging in there for like the whole year hanging up there, but it wasn't for sale. It was the owner of Music Maker had been given this guitar as a gift by Hamer. Yeah. He was the only kind of European stockist of Hamer, as far as I know at the time. And he just had it hanging on the wall. And it was like, it was just, there wasn't a price on it. You couldn't buy it. It was your man's guitar. Like, so anyway, about a month into the summer, there was a price tag on it. It was like, I think it might have been £2,500. Like it was the most expensive guitar in the shop by a mile. And I'm sure even that was just to let people know that you can't buy this guitar. So anyway, long story short is it kept coming down a bit in price. When I say a bit, like it went to $19,999. It went to $17,999, $14,999, $9,999. Still money that nobody 16, 17 could even dream of. And I went in with the rolled up bunch of 20s and handed it over to my mate who was in there. And Dara just said, hang on a sec. And he just went upstairs, spoke to the guy who owned Music Maker at the time, came back down and he went, do you want the hammer? I was like, what do you mean? He goes, do you want the hammer? And would you just take it and leave the shop now? And I was like, yes, yes, I will. He packed it up in the case. I walked out of the shop. He just said, just don't come back in here for a few weeks. I was like, you're fine. You'll never see me again. Wow. And I had to go to a payphone because, again, it was early 90s, ring my mom to tell her to tell my dad when he got home to immediately turn back because he wasn't coming back into town for 3 hours because I was going to meet my mates, you know, and then pick up the guitar later on or whatever. And I was like, no, I'm coming straight home now. So he just literally turned around, drove back into town, picked me up. And yeah, I got this. So what I got was a Hamer Explorer, black and red. They call them a Zulu Blitz. Okay, so the Blitz, I think, is the guitar shape, is their version of an Explorer. I think Zulu is this black and red paint. But the story, which I was told by the lads of Music Maker, and this is where I said, I don't know where the truth of this is, but the story was that Kerry King had been with BC Rich, and he was leaving them as an endorsee, and he was going to another company. So ESP, Hamer, and Jackson, I think, built him custom one-off guitars to show them what they could do, shipped them all out to him. He played each one. He loved ESP and he sent the other two back. I wouldn't have, I would have kept them. But anyway, I suppose he's Kerry King. Yeah. And apparently, as I said, story and story and, you know, whisper and whisper, this Hamer Explorer was what they shipped out to Kerry. And like I said, the pickups match. The Kaler Trem is in this Hamer. They don't put Kaler Trems in Hamers in general, but there's a Kaler Trem in this with the same exact same locking nut mechanism, which is very specific to Kerry. And so then for years, I've always, as I said, told the story, believed the story, because I like to believe that this at one point was played by Kerry King, even though it was never Kerry King's guitar. It was just, he played it, he didn't love it as much as an ESP. And then, as you said, the video for Season of the Abyss comes out. It's black and white mostly, but there's the odd bit of color, and you see this black and red crackle paint, very similar to the Zulu Blitz, with the same pickups, with the same Kaler Trem, and you're kind of going, well, maybe. So then, years later, I mean, probably only about 6 years ago, 7 years ago, maybe, I was having a jam session with a bunch of mates, and I brought the Hamer along because a guy wanted to see a guitar player. And then there's a very peculiar way the locking nut works. And so when you have a guitar that has a floating trem, you need to lock it up at the top of the headstock so that the strings don't go out of tune every time you touch the whammy bar, the tremolo bar. So usually you tighten the bejesus out of something with this, with a, you know, an Allen key or whatever, and that locks the strings in place. With the Kaler system, there's a screw that you tighten to about 3/4, and then you flip down. It's almost like a, you know, in a, you know, in a fighter jet when they flip up the red thing, trigger. It's like for the bomb or whatever. It's like that. It flicks down and it clamps down on the screw and the string that you've already kind of 3/4 tightened. But my mate didn't know this, and he tightened it all the way, as anyone who's ever used a floating trem does, and then pushed the locking like lid down, and it just exploded. The whole thing exploded. And this is like, I mean, pride and joy is not. It's not the way I would describe this guitar. Like, this is, if the house is on fire, I grab this before I grab my kids. Like, I mean, this is like the one guitar, you know. Obviously, he was just beside himself, and I was like, look, dude, accidents happen, you know, it's fine. I'll get in touch with Kaler and see what the crack is. So, rang Kaler, they're based in LA, was chatting away to a really nice guy on the phone. He was like, we don't make that part. He'd asked me to email him. So, I talked to him one day. He said, look, email me pictures and whatever. Emailed him all the pictures, and he rang me back the next day. He was like, we don't make that part anymore. You know, that was specific to the late 80s. There's no way we can match that now. We don't do anything like it. I'm really sorry. And I was like, okay, look, you know, not to worry. And literally, as he's on the phone to me saying goodbye, I hear someone go, talking to him. He's kind of just, he's like, you know, because he's probably on one of those headsets. He goes, just 1 second there, please, Dave. I was like, yeah, no problem.
Yeah, he's like,
Sorry, Gary wants to just have a word with you. And I was like, yeah, cool. Who's Gary? And then in my brain, I go, hang on, Gary Kaler. Like, it's the guy who owns the company. He wants to. So, hey, this is Gary Kaler. Hey, Gary Kaler, why are you talking to me on the phone? So he basically says, in my office, I have a huge, like, wardrobe, basically. And I have one of everything we've ever made. One of everything we've ever made. So I should have this piece that you are looking for. And I was like, come on, seriously? He's like, yeah. He goes, is it gunmetal or anthracite? I think gunmetal gray or something like that. Brass or black? I was like, it's black. And he literally walks away from the phone. I hear, clicks it down the desk, comes back 30 seconds later and goes, yep, have it here. I'm going to send it to you. I was like, oh my God.
Legend. Unbelievable.
So he sent me the piece. He sent me a picture of him holding the piece and a Kaler t-shirt in front of a picture up on the wall of Kerry and Jeff from Slayer. Because he knows that he knew the story. He knew the mm-hmm. situation, whatever. So he and a handwritten note on like a Kaler, like an invoice docket, like, you know, hey Dave, hope the repair goes well. Signed Gary Kaler, like whatever. Like,
what a legend. Wow.
So I rang him back to thank him when it arrived and tell him it was perfect and it was fitted and it was amazing, whatever. And he was chatting away and he said, yeah, he goes, look, I don't remember exactly what we did in the late 80s, but I absolutely. I shipped Kaler parts for every Kerry King guitar. For every personal Kerry, I shipped parts. There's absolutely a chance I shipped it to Hamer in 1988 or whenever, you know, this guitar was built for him. So, look, as I said, I don't have a certificate of authenticity. I don't have a story. You know, I've actually been in touch with...
Take it, Dave, take it.
Yeah, I'm taking it to the grave. Like, you know, but I've been in touch with Hamer themselves recently because I have another Explorer, which is part of the collection I'm looking to shift, for the simple reason that I have this incredible Zulu Blitz that I'm never going to ever leave. So I have this other one, and I just got in touch with them to kind of ask them about the serial number. It's a four-digit serial number, which means it's super. It's actually 1984 this guitar was built, and they were able to give me loads of information. When I asked about my own one, they were like, look, you know, we'd have to dig into the archives. Anything's entirely possible. We can either confirm nor deny kind of thing. And I was like, look, that's fine. I'll leave it there and live in the fantasy.
Yeah. That's
like Kerry touched it at some point, you know.
And is that on the staircase?
That is, yep, it's hanging right. So I've got right at the top, I've three Explorers. I've got the Hamer I'm prepared to sell. I've got the Kerry King inverted commas Hamer there. And then beside that, I have an Ibanez Destroyer. So the three of them, Rising Sun Destroyer, the three of them sit there. But yeah, I mean, it is, as I said, it is the guitar. It is the one I've owned since.
That's the pride and joy.
1991. It is. I mean, there's other guitars that are better than it. There's no doubt about it. You know, I have an Ibanez USA Custom. But that is the guitar.
Your baby.
It's mine. Yeah. I mean, I have videos of me age 16 playing it in the Grattan and Cable Street in Dublin playing Dead Skin Mask and doing the dive bomb with the Kaler trend. Actually, that's on YouTube. Anyone wants to go check it out? If you search,
I must check that out.
You search Afterlife Grattan. So our band was called Afterlife. So if you search Afterlife Grattan, because it was in the Grattan pub, I think it's the only one. The first thing that comes up is I think it's Enter Sandman. Actually, we're playing. It's not in the video. I mean, I know we played it in the set. And actually, my mate still has the video digitized somewhere of the gig. So I might try and get it off him and watch it again and put it up somewhere. But there's definitely Enter Sandman is definitely up there. And some crack.
You grew up listening to the thrash metal, Metallica, Slayer, Anthrax.
Totally.
What albums off the top of your head was you know, some of the best?
The very first thing I ever heard in heavy metal was Kill 'Em All. And not in 83. I was even too young then to hear it. But I was down with my cousins in Limerick in 86. Yeah, I was 11, 86. And I walked in after playing football in the garden as an 11-year-old going, still can't get us. What? What's that? And my older cousin's like, that's Metallica. Class music, so don't learn about it, you go. It's like, all right. So I sat down and literally, I think it was Whiplash was on. I was like, what is this?
Like, it's just an explosion, isn't it?
Totally. Yeah. And so then it was vinyl recorded to tape, was how we shared music in those days. So I went home from Limerick that holiday with Raven, Life's a Bitch on one side of a 90-minute cassette, and Metallica, Kill 'Em All on the other side. Wow. And it literally changed my life. Like that tape, like, was the first bit of metal I ever heard. And then, because it was 86, I was then able to go and get Ride the Lightning and get Master of Puppets. And then I was there the day Justice came out. Wow. Like, in the shop.
Unbelievable.
Like, yeah. Like, and that is my favorite album of all time. Like,
Mine too.
Musical perfection. And one of my biggest claims to fame is I was at the Justice tour in the top hat, Dunleary, in 1988. I was 13 years old. My first ever gig, ever.
Oh, man. Like, I don't think that can be beat.
I don't think so. Like, unless you were there in 86 and saw Cliff on the Puppets tour. But like, I was 11 then, so I was only learning about. In fact, by the time I had heard Kill 'Em All, I think the gig had happened, the 86 gig had happened. But
that gig was in the SFX, wasn't it?
Yeah, Puppets was SFX, and then the Top Hat in Dunleary was where they played when I went to them. But like, I'd never, as I said, the livest music I'd ever heard was the choir in Mass. That was as live as I'd ever heard. And then I walked in and Danzig were playing like satanic love songs. And I was like, my mate looked like James McGurk, the fellow with me, two 13-year-olds going, what's happening? like massive men bashing each other and moshing. And because, I mean, you got to remember as well, like, I didn't even know what to do at a gig. Like, there was no YouTube. There was no, like, I'll just check it out. I'll go to setlist.fm and see what they played on the last date in Belfast. No, I had no idea. I didn't know what the hell was happening. Yeah. And then, I don't know if you know the story, but before they did Cunning Stunts, this was on a much smaller scale, but the Lady Justice statue came apart in like four pieces, and like there was dry ice shooting like, and as like there were men in their 20s thought it was real, that something malfunction was happening. I was a 13-year-old kid maybe crying going, what's happening? I don't know. Or Metallica, okay. it was like, again, talk about moments that change your life. Like, that was just like life altering, and seeing those lads play, you know,
Lady Doris's reign of terror above on stage.
And fucking Hetfield's right hand, man. Jesus. Like, and
if that was 88, Dave, like, he would have had the Eat Fuck Explorer from the MTV video. You probably would have got to see the More Beer in action.
Yeah.
Like, Eat Fuck More Beer.
Yeah, Diego Meister. What was So What was his second backup, Gibson.
Yeah.
Have you got Messengers?
Yes, I got it for Christmas. My wife got it for me.
Yeah, so did my my mother got it for me. It's absolutely incredible.
What a gift. Yeah, unbelievable. Look, I mean, like, that, I think that era to me was James was at his best. It was his peak in terms of, you know, his, like, the speed they played Creep and Death. Like,
Writing.
Oh, listen, look, as I said, musically, I think it's the best thing that anyone's ever done. You know, like, I think it is my favorite album of all time. But I do think, like, to see him perform that stuff at the pace he performed it at in that era was just, at the time, obviously, you know, I knew, I listened, I remember, I literally remember Creep and Death going, Like, yeah. This is so much faster than the record, saying to my friend, I didn't even know that people sped things up live. You know, As I said, I had never been to a gig. Like,
yeah.
But to hear that, it genuinely was, you could hear, you go, like, this is insane what he's doing.
Yeah.
And then I suppose looking back years later, maybe, you know, you don't quite appreciate every nuance and detail that, you know, I have hazy memories of it now, 6 years later. But it was just, yeah, it was like just insane to be there. And then after that, then it was McGonagall's. Almost every 2 weeks, there was an amazing metal gig at McGonagall's all through the 80s and 90s. And, you know, Zentrix or Slammer or Sacred Reich, Acid Rain. Like,
Acid Rain, yeah.
We'd go to these, like, I would go to almost every gig that was on. You know, again, 14, 15, getting the dart into town, because I went to school in town, so it wasn't a really alien thing for my parents to allow me to go to town. So, you know, you'd on a Friday night, you'd come home from school, get your thrash metal t-shirt and your hoodie on, and you'd go back into town, walk up from Tara Street or Pier Street, go to South Down Street, go see an amazing gig, get the head bashed off you in the best way possible.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Buy a t-shirt and then head home on the last dart. You know, like, it was stuff of dreams, you know what I mean?
Simpler times.
Yeah.
Bring it back.
Then you got into the grunge a bit, Dave, did you?
Yeah, so that band Afterlife. So basically, I have a guitar kind of brother, a guy called Donica Costello, who he went to school together. So he was the first person I ever knew with an electric guitar, and he invited me over to his house in first year in school, and he said, I have an electric guitar and I can play it through an amp. And I was like, oh my God, like, you're literally James Hetfield to me. Do you know what I mean? So I went over to his house and he plugged it into his dad's stereo system and hit record on a tape deck, and it somehow went in the headphone jack. And so his dad was an electronic engineer, so I think he had reversed the headphone jack into an input, and then if you hit record, it would come out the tape selector on the amp or whatever it was. It sounded so bad. Like, it was the worst distortion you can imagine, but it was distortion. And this, it blew my mind. And then the second time I went out to him, he had figured out, or his dad had figured out, how to multi-track. Now, just two tracks, but how to multi-track. So Dunica played the guitar chords to From the Bell Tolls, and I sang it. And I mean, I sang it like 12, like, make his fight on the like, literally at that. But again, he has it somewhere. But he has been my brother in guitar, and always like 2-3 levels ahead of me. So always something for me to aspire to. Oh, Dunica can do power chords. I want to learn power chords. Dunica can do a guitar solo. He can do tapping. I want to learn. So I've always followed him that way, and still the same now. Like, you know, I'm definitely a rhythm player. He's definitely a lead player. And that was us in the band, James and Kirk, whatever, you know, yeah, kind of thing. And he's,
I think we all had someone like that, though. I don't,
you have to.
You know, even with the knowledge with music and metal, you always had someone that, oh, do you know this band now? It was like, you know, it was the librarian opening the door. Oh, come on down this aisle here now. Let me show you this. Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah. I remember the first album I got was Number of the Beast.
Wow.
Yeah, and my next door neighbor, yeah, he opened it for me. It was Iron Maiden, and then it was Pantera, Metallica.
We owe these lads so much, don't we? Like, I'm my cousins. Man.
I still talk to them. Like, I don't live there anymore. And I anytime I see him, I'm like, man, you opened my ears and my eyes. And he's like, I told you, giving me down CDs. And
But Dunnick and I, we were in Afterlife. So if you see that Afterlife Grattan video, he's the lead guitar player in that. Built guitars together. The guitar he's playing actually is a White Explorer that he hand built himself, and then quickly I followed him and built a Flying V with him. And then about 18, sixth year in school, about 17, 18, we decided, we were sick of metal gigs at the level we were playing them, right? Because you just bring your amp and you might get it plugged in, or you might get a mic shut up against it and it goes through PA, or you mightn't. So the vocals going through the PA, the drums are as loud as they can be. No one's mixing it. And like the Grattan, you know what I mean? Like, you're just playing it. And it's great. Look, Gorilla gigs are amazing. But everything sounded shit. And we were just if we want to be serious about a band, we're going to have to get loads of money and invest in our own PA and our own mixing desk. And we're going to have to bring an engineer, front house engineer to every gig, whatever. But because we really wanted to be musicians at this point, this was our dream. Like, and we were invested in it in terms of, we weren't messing around. It was either do it right or we weren't doing it. So grunge had happened, and we loved Pearl Jam, we loved Soundgarden, and Nirvana were just kind of coming on the scene. And we watched Pearl Jam Unplugged, yeah. Alice in Chains Unplugged, Nirvana Unplugged, and then got a brainwave and went, why don't we just be unplugged all the time? Mm. Why don't we buy good acoustic guitars and play grunge and play in weird time signatures and play in drop D and tune the guitar to E flat and play in drop C sharp and whatever, but do it on acoustics with a bass player, a drummer, and two acoustic guitars and whatever. And we were like, let's try it. So we did try it. We immediately wrote the best songs we'd ever written. Wow. We got the other three guys in the band. Another guy was a really good writer, John Paul Doyle. And the three of us just, we just kept writing and we harmonized like you wouldn't believe. Vocal harmonized like was, so I was, sorry, I was a singer at this point. JP and Dunica were the guitar players. Sean was the bass player. And Matt, who had been our drummer all the way through all our bands, was the drummer. And that was the band that we won the Battle of the Bands with in Trinity, that got us the money to go and record the album, that gave me the moment in the studio going, oh, this is what I want to do. I didn't want to be in the band anymore. But he and I just did this acoustic grunge thing. God Magic Riddle was the name of our band. Suitably grungy nonsense. Yeah. But we made that album and I sold it in Trinity for, I think we sold it for £4 or £6. JP designed the cover. My mother printed it out in her job on red paper. And I cut them with scissors and folded them into the shape of a cassette and sold those cassettes all through Trinity. And there are people who I still meet now who go, oh, you're Dave. Yeah. You're on the radio. Cool. Yeah. I was in the arts block in Trinity in 1994 and I bought your album. I still have it at home on tape, but I don't have a tape player anymore. I'm like, what is happening? How do these people have the record I released like in 1993 or 1994 or whatever? But actually, again, funny, mad stuff. We only won, I think we won £600 and we worked out this studio in Ranelagh in Dublin. We could do two overnight sessions. So it's £300 and overnight. So that would allow us to go in and record a couple of songs. And then when we got in there, we realized we were actually really quick because we were such a rehearsed band. We were so tight. So we actually did 11 songs, recorded overdubbed harmonies, strings on the keyboard, whatever. But like I said, the guy didn't know what he was doing. So the drums sound like the worst thing you've ever heard and everything's bad. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But on the second night, we walked around to the Spar to buy like Lucozade or crisps or whatever to try and get us through another sleepless night.
Coke Zero.
No, the Coke Zero didn't exist at the time. Would you believe? Yeah. Wasn't a chance. This was 94. And the reason I know it was 94 is because on the radio, again, I had never worked in radio, no interest in radio in 94. Guy went, singer Kurt Cobain has been found dead.
Oh, man.
And it was the night we were recording our kind of grungy, it wasn't Nirvana, but it was grunge influenced music. And it was like, went back to the studio, told the other lads, it was like, what the fuck? Like, you know what I mean? It was just a mind-blowing scenario to finish that piece of work that we were doing against the background of Kirk, you know, Kirk not being there anymore. So that was kind of a wild scenario. But yeah, look, I mean, he and I are still best mates. You know, we hang out all together all the time. I do this thing with my friends called guitar play dates. And we basically all get together and we bring as many of our guitars as we can fit in our cars. We go to places like Camden Recording Studios. We go here. When they're in my house, I call them guitar-bacues. And just cook stuff on and get all the lads over. And we'd, like, I as I said, I have a 9-rack there. I have another 9-rack I'd bring down. And the lads bring over, you know, between 10 or 15 guitars, a couple of Helix things, plug into a PA here in the front room. And we just play all day. And it's just, I mean, it's not even about, like, we're not jamming. We're not trying to play songs. But we're, you know, with a digital calipers, we're measuring neck diameters. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is the kind of stuff we're doing. You know what I mean?
The nerdy stuff. The fun stuff.
Yeah, absolutely love it. Couldn't be happier. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, so, absolutely. Yeah, that's the kind of stuff I love doing and still do with Dunica now today. And he's an unbelievable musician. And for years was like Ireland's number one techno music export. Like, I mean, in the world of techno music, he's still a name that people like will know and will absolutely go, holy Jesus, you know Dunica Costello. Like he's right up there. So he's an unbelievable musician. So always been an inspiration. And as I said, still one of my best mates, you know.
Deadly. Dave, before we finish up, if you don't mind doing a couple of questions quickly before we wrap it up.
Go for it, yeah.
If you could play guitar with any band for one night, who would it be?
Yeah, it's got to be Metallica, right? I wouldn't mind replacing Sting on bass. I don't want to sing and play the bass because I don't know how he does that, but I would look I think I'd love to hang out with Sting, like be his friend. Do you know that way?
Yeah.
I'd love to do that. So I'd love to play bass him. No, but I think, yeah, Jesus Christ, like if you could play, could you play, could your right hand handle being up there with James Hetfield? I don't know. But okay, assuming I'm good enough, right?
Yes.
I would love to play Justice, the Justice album with Metallica.
Oh,
yeah.
Man. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That would be the dream. I mean, look, Slayer, Testament, you know. Oh, do you know actually who I love, who are criminally underrated? Is Dark Angel. Angel released an album called Time Does Not Heal not just after Justice, but I think it may be a year or two after Justice. But they put a sticker on the front of the album that said this album contains, I think it was something like 262 riffs. And the point was it had more riffs on it than Justice for All had. And their thing was, we're more technical than the peak Metallica. And they were. Gene Hoglan was the drummer, like literally the best drummer that's ever lived. Like my favorite drummer of all time. But that album, Time Does Not Heal, like I must listen to that, I'd say, twice a week, every week now. And I wouldn't listen to Justice that much, but okay. But again, if you give me the choice, Justice is the peak.
Take Justice.
But yeah, that album, I think if anyone's listening who loves metal, who hasn't heard that, check out. Darkness Descends is their seminal album, but Time Does Not Heal, I think, is the most of that type of thrash metal, speed metal, technical metal, whatever you want to call it. I think that is genuinely the peak of technicality. I think, yeah, Justice has better songs. It's a better album. But if you want to listen to lads playing at the absolute zenith of their all the powers in the whole world at that point, Dark Angel, Time Does Not Heal is it.
Wow. Incredible. Just on the topic of Metallica there, quickly, what's your take on their newer stuff?
Look, Metallica had four incredible albums, and then the Black Album was 50-50 for me.
Okay.
Like obviously production wise, sound wise, like, you know, and the importance of that album, like none of those things can be called into question. And obviously some of the songs are unbelievable. Like,
yeah,
you know, I mean, Of Wolf and Man, like Holier Than Thou.
Yeah.
There's a lot of,
you know, I think there's a lot of songs that don't get the credit that's on that album.
Do you know why? Do you know why? Sure. I think, because I think a lot of them were not on Justice. I think there are songs on the Black Album
That would make sense, Dave.
Yeah,
that sound, if you think of that sort of scooped or that distortion at the start of Wolf of Man, that sort of womp, bump, bump, bump before it comes in. When you think of those sort of darker solos, the like of some of the stuff Kirk does in One, transcribes a wee bit into that Wherever I May Roam feel.
That's right. Yeah.
And even the solo on The God That Failed coming in with the tapping is very Justice-esque for like the frayed ends of sanity.
I never thought of it like that.
You know, one of these stuff.
Yeah, I think you're right there. I think there are a lot of songs on that record that at least, because you remember the way Metallica makes songs. Like it's riffs. We're gonna use riff. Lars always has them catalogued, you know, riff A16 going into riff D42 is how, you know, there's absolutely riffs on the Black Album that were supposed to be on Justice but didn't fit for whatever reason. So I do love that record, but there are things, you know, if I never hear Nothing Else Matters around Sandman again, I'm fine. Do you know what I mean? Enter Sandman is probably the most important metal song that's ever been recorded, right? Because it changed metal from being this underground thing to being this huge, you know, glow. And Metallica are still the biggest, one of the biggest bands, one of the biggest heavy metal bands. They're one of the biggest bands in the world.
Definitely, yeah.
You know, that album is the reason why. But, you know, but I think everything from there, so Load and Reload can fuck off. Like, I have no time for them whatsoever.
Okay.
Yeah, Fuel's all right. There's a couple of, like,
the Outlaw Torn I like.
You see, here's the thing. I probably could tell you in exact order the track listing of Kill 'Em All, Ride the Lightning, Master Puppets, Justice for All, and the length of the songs.
Yeah.
Like, I will tell you now, The Creeping Death is 6 minutes and 36 seconds, and I know this for an absolute fact, right? And I will be able to do that with all of those four records. I cannot tell you the track listing of Load or Reload. I don't know. I don't know Saint Anger that way, Death Magnetic. You know, none of those things. Hardwired definitely came back for me. Like, that was when I started. There were songs in that, and I was like, no, like, this is starting to sound decent. And then 72 Seasons, I think, is a great record. I really do.
Really
like that.
Really good record, yeah.
Now, look, like, why, like, Metallica had to change and had to do Load and Reload in order to survive and to still be gigging in 2024. Slayer didn't. Slayer were unique, maybe a little bit like Rage Against the Machine, in the sense that they just released the same record time and time and time again, and everyone was fine with that. And okay, they experimented with drop tunings in the later stuff, you know, and they finished on an absolute high. Who knew they were coming back this summer? Funny thing, I got across the them. But they, you know, they didn't change. Whereas Metallica, if Metallica had stayed doing Justice type records, they just wouldn't exist anymore.
No, they rode the wave, like.
They did, and they changed metal. They changed the music scene globally for every metal band that has come since. And grunge couldn't happen, and new metal couldn't happen, and none of this could have happened without Metallica writing that record and then going on doing what they did. That, you know, those tours after the Black Album and all that. Like, you know, all of that completely changed the face. And, like, they deserve all the respect in the world, going through tragedy and lineup change and all these things. But no, I don't listen to anything. I listened to the first four records, the odd song on the Black Album, nothing from 1991 until 2015, and then a little bit of Hardwired and a lot of 72 Seasons. But, like, I'm putting on a Metallica album, I'm putting on Ride the Lightning, like, I'm putting on Justice. I'm not, The Thing That Should Not Be might be the best song that's ever been recorded.
Yeah,
like,
honestly, you know what I mean? Heaviest. So,
like, yeah, well, I'm not going to put on, like, give me fuel, give me, like, when James started going, ooh, and I was like, you know what, like, I'm done, you know what I mean? Go back to fucking, fuck yeah! Like, you know, like, you know, so, like, I don't know. Look,
man, up your ass.
Yeah, and they're incredible, like I said. They are literally the reason I love metal, is Kill 'Em All. So, you know, I can never, and the fact, I went to see them in Hamburg last year on the 72 Seasons tour, so the two nights in Hamburg.
Nice.
And the fact that at nearly 60, I'm going to see a band that are selling out a football stadium in Germany, two nights out of a weekend. Like, how can I have any negative stuff around Metallica? Like, they did this. They are here today. And you can still go and see. You can't go and see a lot of the favorite bands you had. Like, I can't go see Zentrix. Mm-hmm. They might do a gig in the Voodoo Lounge if I'm lucky. But that's the level those bands were at. Sacred Reich. You know, they might play the Academy if you're lucky, whatever. Metallica, you can go and see in the biggest venues. They've got the best sound system. They've got, like, the unbelievable pyro, incredible stages, best merchandise. Like, you can't take these things for granted. So I suppose it's just that thing of, like, you know, there are bits of Metallica that are terrible and are cringe and some kind of monster documentary and all that stuff.
Oh,
but, like, it's all part of the story. And
it's all part of the process.
They're one thing. That's Metallica. You know what I mean? And that's, you know, you have to kind of take every single bit of them to like the first four albums. You have to take the rest of the stuff with it. So I do, you know.
Well, they definitely have the blueprint to be a successful band. Like, 40 years, over 40 years, like, man.
Insane.
Yeah, this struck great.
Yeah. I don't think anybody will do what they've done.
Not at all. It's impossible now. I mean, artists, whatever, even outside of metal, even in pop, like, you know, Bruce Springsteen's still going, you know, like,
the Stones are still touring.
The Stones are doing it. Like, you forget even about touring in your 70s. You won't have bands and artists now, other than the top 0.1%, who will be relevant in 30 years. As in, you can go back and listen to the Stones, listen to Elton John, listen to Bruce Springsteen, and go, they're amazing songs. Like, if you look at it, and I work in pop every day, and I love pop, but just the industry has changed. Yeah. Not that the writing has got worse. It's just that the way we consume music now is completely different. It's a post-it note, at best. And you rip it off your screen, and you throw it in the bin, and you whatever. Whereas, like, as I said, you go back to when I owned the first four albums on cassette, first four Metallica albums, and I sat there with the inlay cards and I scoured them to see, was there any more information about this band and this song, and reading about Fleming Rasmussen and going, who even knew what a producer was in 1984? But I all of a sudden knew about Fleming Rasmussen, you know.
And where they recorded this album, and this was in Denmark, and they used the only modded Marshall that was in Denmark, and then the...
the fucking kit got stolen, and you know all of these. Holy. I love that story, Dave, where they talk about tuning Lars's kit.
You know,
it had to be tuned because they were in that like heated room, so with the cold, it would get cold and detune, and then the producers would spend time with him trying to fuck around to get the drum sound like every session.
But that's the thing, like that means so much to us. So then the music cannot be throwaway. Like, you know, the Call of Cthulhu cannot be something you just delete and move on from. Like, it can't be. Whereas now, you know, artists come out, they don't even release albums. They release 10 singles in 10 months and they're top of the top 10 things and whatever. And then it's like, but what about your album in the order that you wanted people to listen to it with the lyrics? None of that happens. And it's nobody's fault. It's just the way the industry is. But I think you're not going to have people in music last the way Metallica have lasted. And last the way their back catalogue has lasted, and last the way Slayer's has, or Testament's has, or whatever. It's just, it's not going to happen, you know. And that's, as I said, it's not anybody's fault. It's not that anyone who's trying to be a metal musician now, you know, isn't as talented as Hetfield and Ulrich. They're probably more talented, but there's magic and mercury striking when people like that get together. And you just realize, you go like, you know, we're here now at the same time the Metallica are around. I'm really, really happy about that. You know
what I mean? Absolutely, man.
What a time to be alive.
Yeah.
But back to saying that about the albums, Dave, like there's very few people that will listen to an album back to front.
So true. I say to artists all, because I interview people all the time who release records. And I ask them, I love asking that question, going, did you plan your track list with your marketing people? Or did you guys do it as a band or an artist or whatever it is? And by and large, they all did it themselves. They all had a reason for that song to follow that song. Okay, maybe the manager goes, look, the single has to be track one, you know, or track two or whatever. But, you know, like Master Puppets was track two, Justice was track two. There were patterns back then, you know what I mean? But I suppose, you know, They don't get that luxury of having people want to just consume every piece of information that can be consumed about the music, because then they want to know, who are you dating? What did you put in your Instagram? Are you on TikTok? So you know, all those things. It's so a different world, you know. And I mean, I remember Metal Hammer magazine. In fact, Dunnick bought me a copy of it only last Friday. He picked one up and gave it to me when he was on the train. But I remember getting Metal Hammer magazine and getting Kerrang. And like, I would go through it like literally paragraph by paragraph and make sure I understood everything.
Yeah, dissected.
That was written as going, hang on, so that guy went out with Doro Pesh in, you know, for she was, oh, right, I didn't realize that. And so then that's why they don't get on with this band, or, oh, okay, you know. And like your knowledge of the metal world was so big and so detailed, and you were such a fan. Mm-hmm. Now, like, you know, as I said, if it's not on their Instagram stories, you know, you're not consuming it.
Your attention span is totally gone now.
It's just look, it's a different world. And I actually feel for musicians now, particularly musicians who have spanned both eras. Like, you know, even in Ireland, like, you know, when I think of a band like the Coronas, right? The Coronas began life in the early 2000s when CDs were a thing. Mm-hmm. And when hearing them on the radio was amazing. And hearing them being interviewed gave you these kinds of insights. And Hot Press doing a cover story about them or reviewing their album at the back was a massive deal. The Coronas now, like, they have to treat the industry completely differently than they did. You know, and even a younger band like Codaline have to treat the industry completely differently than they did when they began. So, you know, I really feel for those kinds of artists. And look, we haven't even gotten into the world of metal or artists in Ireland or anywhere in the world, how difficult it is to not be pop. You know, the Coronas made a decision to just do their own thing. When everyone turned their back on guitar music, they went, well, we're going to be more guitar. And I love that about those guys. Yeah, you know, they know what they want. They know what the art they want to produce. And even if it means drop off in sales and smaller gigs, whatever, they just want to do the right thing for them. And that's like Metallica, I guess, in some ways. You know, like, they make these hard decisions, bands and professional musicians do all the time, that maybe we don't, as fans, you know, we don't understand. Like, why is this Thrice record different than the last Thrice record? I like the last Thrice record. Well, Thrice needs to do a different record, because otherwise they won't be a band anymore and you won't have them. You're like, okay, I'll listen to it. Oh my God, it's actually really good. If I'd listened to it properly the first time, I would, you know. So this stuff happens all the time. I mean, you just need to... You need to just kind of give credit to people who are managing to stick around. And actually, you know what? I don't know when this podcast is going out, but in real life, the next two nights of my life are going to be supporting two of the most influential bands on me in modern times, and certainly two of the bands that have stood up in the face of how the industry works and have made it work for themselves. One is Enter Shikari, who are playing the Academy Thursday and Friday night. I'm going Thursday night.
I'm flying to London. Fever 333 aren't supporting them on the Irish run, because
the Irish tour
plays drums with them and he's an animal.
Oh, absolutely. But then on Friday, I'm flying to London with Dermot, who I did the radio show with, to see Fightstar. And Fightstar is Charlie Simpson from Busted. Yes. If you don't know, I'm not joking.
We were talking about this the other day, actually, with Luke Priest, who designs the illustrations for Metallica.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Look, they are honestly, I would say, Fightstar are my top five bands of all time. I cannot tell you how much I love these guys. And their music, they just stopped in 2015. And then Charlie went back to, you know, Busted, because, hey, what sells out, you know,
Mick Busted and McFly for years.
Yeah. Listen, and I mean, he's got a family. He's got
it's a job at the end of the day too, like, you know.
Yeah, it is a job. But Fightstar are back for one night only, they say. We'll see. But they're doing their album that's 20 years old, Grand Unification. They're playing that in full. Like, I introduced Dermot to them years back when they came out first, about 2005, 2006. God, I love them so much, and they're so amazing, and he's such an incredible vocalist, and I just can't wait to see them. But they're like, there's two bands that, you know, Enter Shikari, you know, they've both been signed to major labels, they've both been dropped, but they've kept going. You know, okay, Fightstar have been quiet for 9 years, but, you know, Enter Shikari released album after album after album, such high quality stuff. They've put out merchandise, they've embraced the future, they've got a social conscience. They're unbelievable on so many levels, but they're never going to sell the Three Arena out. Do you know what I mean? Like, they're going to do the Academy, and if they're lucky, they'll do the Academy twice. But I love that about them. I love that they know where they're at, they know what they can do, and they give it absolutely everything. Everything, you know?
Daily. Dave, we finished with this last question. I'm going to turn it on you, the Music Master question.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Are you up for a bit of crack?
Yeah, absolutely. I embarrass the life out of myself now.
I'll go easy on you, right? We start with, okay, the year is 1958.
58, okay.
The location is Minneapolis.
Right.
The lyric, I was working part-time in a five and dime. My boss was Mr. McGee.
Why can I sing that in my head right now?
Will I give him a hint?
Yeah, I need a hint. I'm so glad this isn't on the radio.
The tables have turned, Dave.
I'd be strung up.
Think, red Toro Bravo 4s, similar colour.
Oh my God, we're getting sneakers into this as well. 58. Old as shit. It's older than me.
He's brown bread.
He's brown bread now. No, you've got me.
Think of Lars's drum kit off the Hardwired tour. What colour was it?
Hardwired tour.
Or the Worldwired tour, I should say, from 2017. The one he would have played in Slain. The same colour as my Ouija.
Oh, purple. Deep purple.
Someone that...
Oh, Purple Rain, Minneapolis. Fuck, of course.
Dave.
Five and dime. Dave. Yeah, you see? This is why I'm the quiz master and not the person playing the game. I am rubbish. Yes.
I thought you'd nail that one, man.
Listen, I was thinking you guys are going to ask me about, like, you know, like the lead singer of, like, you know, some obscure thrash metal band from Minneapolis. Well, I was like, who's...
Oh, no, we wouldn't do that to you, Dave. We wouldn't do that.
Right. Fair play to that.
Last one. The year is 1960. The location is New Orleans, Louisiana. Now, this is a band lead singer.
Right,
lead singer. The lyric is, can you hear violins playing your song? Those same friends tell me your every word.
I don't know the lyric. 60 New Orleans. Go on, give me another hint.
They're touring again at the minute.
In Australia.
With a revamped lineup because some of the members have passed away.
Not Fest Festival. Texas, a lot of them was from Texas.
Huge Dallas Cowboys fans.
Pantera?
Yeah. Phil Anselmo.
Jesus, yeah. God, yeah, yeah. No, see,
that was a tough one.
I'd be so bad at Music Master.
Yeah. Dave, it's been a pleasure chatting to you, man.
Lads, I've enjoyed this so much. I would have chatted all night and I'd probably rabbited on for far too long.
No, man. I don't want to take up any more of your time, man. But
yeah,
no,
we could definitely do this for another couple of hours.
Well, let's do another episode in another season. Get me back on. There's more to talk about, I'm sure.
We'll talk about sneakers and talk about other bands.
Absolutely. And sure, look, if I keep releasing music and you keep playing drums on it, you never know what might happen.
Man. Yeah. We could get it together.
I can play the triangle.
There you go. Arguably soaking Lars.
Will you play the keg like the boys had a slip?
Baseball bat and a keg. That's all you need.
Oh, man, talk about Slipknot. Just before
stop. We didn't even talk about Slipknot. The fact that, like,
I seen them at that gig in 2003 in the RDS.
Wow, same. And
that story.
I was born in 86. What? I don't even know. I was about
you, are you?
No, I was younger. I don't know what it was. I can't count right now. But I was, late teenager anyway, 70. Heading up to Dublin. And I remember in the RDS drinking the bottle of Southern Comfort. A small wolf. And me and my buddies were like, who's opening, Metallica? Slipknot, and they're only starting to come out. What album was out?
That would have been Iowa.
Yeah. Iowa, yeah.
And I heard this noise, man. I'm like, what is this shit?
Yeah.
I walked into it, and that song, when everyone gets down on the floor?
Oh, yeah, People Equals Shit.
Was it People? It was one of them. And next
or Custer.
It was Custer, I think. But yeah. I got to see them, actually. As they were walking on the stage along the fence, I could see like two or three people like, Joey. And, I'm like, holy shit, that's the band, But, oh my God, they blew my mind that day.
Yeah.
They were in the prime, pegging kegs around the place. Joey, just unbelievable.
No way, Corey.
Oh, man.
So that's, I'm holding up a picture for the lads of me and Corey. Basically, again, Dan, right? So the guy I spoke about at the start for the Netflix thing, the TV director. Yes. One of the jobs he did over the years was direct Doctor Who. And Corey and Jim from Slipknot are massive Doctor Who fans. I mean, massive Doctor Who fans. So an email came from Slipknot's management to the BBC saying the lads are gigging in Manchester. Doctor Who was made in Manchester. Doctor Who is currently being made in Manchester. Jim and Corey know this. Is there any chance before the gig they could come down and see the set?
No way.
So BBC turn around to obviously Dan is the director, so it's kind of Dan's call. And they're like, do you know this band Slipknot? They sound like heavy metal nonsense. And Dan is a massive metalhead like me because we grew up in the same world. And he's like, sorry, Corey, Jim, the Slipknot want to come down here. It's like, get them down here immediately.
Yeah.
So Corey and Jim come down. Like, Dan gives them the full tour, takes like 2 hours off, shuts the whole production down, costs them thousands, but like shows them everything.
Wow.
And then gets a brainwave and Jim has to go back over and he goes to Corey, do you want a part in this episode? And Corey's like he's already, his mind's completely blown. He's like, what? And he goes, look, I can't put you on camera, but I have a monster in this part that's attacking like David Capaldi.
No way.
Or Peter Capaldi. And he's like, so he's being voiced by someone else, but I wanted to work in a scream. So we were just going to get one of the sound guys to scream, but you're Corey Taylor. Do you want to scream? And he's like, yeah. So he screams for this monster in this episode of Doctor Who. It's Corey Taylor. So then Corey, when he's leaving, says, are you guys coming to the shows tonight? Because there's a couple other guys on the crew who love metal as well. And they're like, oh, well, we didn't really get tickets because we're so busy and whatever. And he goes, okay, you don't need tickets. Just if you can come down, just come down. How many of you will there be? And they're like, four. And he's like, okay, Dan, plus three at the door, VIP everything, just whatever you want. Nice. So the lads finish up and go, come on, we've got to go. So they go down side of stage with the wives, right? So this is in Manchester. At one point in the show, Corey comes over, peels the mask off, takes a massive drink of water out of a bottle, looks, sees Dan, who's standing there, grabs Dan by the scruff of the neck, and he goes, it's take your fucking friends to work day. Pulls his mask back down, goes back out. Dan is just like, this is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. And then they stay in touch by email. And text, whatever, mostly email. And then they're coming to Dublin. So Dan texts Corey, or emails Corey, and goes, look, you know, we haven't been in touch in 6 months, you know, like we only text and email the odd time, whatever, but you're coming to Dublin, it's my hometown. And Dan lives in the UK, it is in Edinburgh, but he's flying in to go to Slipknot with me. And he's like, look, you know, my friend is kind of, gets free tickets and shit, so we're already in, I don't need tickets, but if there was any chance we could meet you, it'd be so great to see you, you know, it's been 3 years or whatever. He's straight back, like within minutes, he's back going, amazing. Right, come at this point, I'll send someone, where will you be? We're in the 1878 club. He's like, I'll send someone to you. I'll come. So this guy just walks up and he goes, Dan? And Dan's like, yeah. And he goes, you and your friends can come down. We just walk down into the guts of the Three Arena. And we're talking to the tour manager, who again, Dan knows. And then Corey literally walked past, like he was like, Dan! And he came in and just talked to us for 20 minutes. Jim just walked. I really wanted to meet Jim. Like, I just think Jim is such an amazing guitar player. He walked in, he kind of saw us all, and he just like turned on his heels and went to his dressing room, whatever. He was like, I'm not talking to those guys or whatever. But it was just unreal. Like Sid was knocking about, just saying hello.
2020, was it?
2020, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I was at that one myself, yeah.
Yeah.
The sound, oh my God. It was so loud.
It was. Yeah, I actually wear in-ear protectors all the time for all gigs now. And we literally won't go to a gig without them because it's just too harsh. Like
I actually was
on the.
I was actually sitting at that gig because I couldn't get floor seats, and
I only go front row balcony. I'm not going anywhere else.
Oh my God! Looking down at the floor, I was just like, "That is insane."
You'd want to be in the Goodyear health to be in the pit.
Oh my!
Absolutely,
God.
It's a younger man's game. That's for sure.
Well, we actually the last crazy. Gig we were at, it was in the Grand Social, was Kublai Khan TX.
Oh, yeah.
Man, they were savage. They were
brilliant.
That was
incredible.
They were only supporting Chelsea Grin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were a bit too heavy for my...
I know what you mean, yeah.
A bit too death. But Kublai Khan, we actually got to meet them.
Yeah.
No way, that's the thing with those kind of venues. Yeah, you do, you know?
Matt Honeycutt, the singer, and Eric, the bassist, were on the merch stand.
Yeah.
And then myself and Gavin were feeling like we went out of fire exit. We went out the way that we came in. We were a little late to the gig.
Yeah.
And the guy was like, down the back and up the stairs. And
didn't we take our tickets.
Yeah, it didn't take our tickets or anything.
It's not Corey Taylor. Or
no, sure. Yeah, yeah.
But we come down the stairs and Isaac, the drummer from Kublai Khan, is just standing there loading in his gear or loading out. Yeah, and we got to stand and talk to him, and I got some sticks and have a crack with him for 10 minutes. And it's just
but that
fabulous.
Was always the way at gigs. Like, I remember, as I said, McGonagall's before on South Ann Street, or even the Academy now. Like, if you want to meet the band, you just go around the back of the venue, and they're always loading the gear in. And those kinds of gigs. Like, they don't have people to load in their drum gear and their amps and whatever. You don't. They're doing it themselves, so you get to meet everybody, you know?
But even back in the day, I've heard stories. I don't think they're bullshit stories, to be honest. But, like, I know guys that met... was it AC/DC that recorded an album in Dublin? Was it AC/DC?
You were telling... Alice in Chains.
Alice
you were telling
Chains.
Me.
Yeah,
and Stanley came out with the guys.
Yeah.
You talk about the SFX. So, like, I was in school, or literally around the corner from the SFX. My homework journals in like second year, third year were signed by Dave Mustaine, James Hetfield, Lane Staley. Like, there were lads who were sorry, not James Hetfield, but Dave Mustaine, Lane Staley, Phil Anselmo, because they gigged in the SFX. And we were finished school at 3:30. That was sound check. So we'd walk around and just wait outside. And like, you know, the roadies would go in and say, there's a couple of kids outside. Whatever. And like, we didn't have anything. We're in our uniforms. So we took out our homework journals and they just like signed them. Like, it was hilarious. Like,
that's unbelievable.
Yeah, that happened all the time. Like, and, you know, okay, the bigger bands in the bigger venues, you know, certainly by the time the show was on, you weren't seeing anybody. But if you were there in the afternoon, like, who else was knocking about, like, off Gardner Street at 3:30 on a Tuesday afternoon when Pantera were playing later that night? You know what I mean? Like, so.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, them days are gone. I don't think they're going to come back with that, you know,
price of tickets.
Yeah, geez.
Yeah.
My God, I just, yeah. It's gone crazy. AC/DC and was it Stevie Nicks?
Stevie Nicks, yeah.
Robert Bank. Yeah. I'd love to see her though. She'd be amazing.
Ah, stop. Yeah, be unreal.
Yeah. But I think we'll leave it there, won't we?
Yeah. Dave, one more question before we go.
On, yeah.
It'll take.
Better not be another music match. I'm not embarrassing myself anymore.
No. To play on that sound podcast, I ask everybody, what is their most preferable sound, or what is your most desired sound in an album, or guitar sound for yourself, or bass, if you want, if you can think of that holy grail.
Yeah, perfect it is. Sound. It is absolutely the bassless double guitar of Hetfield on A Justice for All.
Yeah,
that is my favorite sound.
And
I've listened to Jason's unbelievable bass tracks. I know how good they are. I don't care. The album is perfect as it is. It's supposed to sound that way.
Yeah.
The guitar sound in Blackened, the guitar sound in The Shortest Draw, like, these are the things that sustain me and keep me alive. And
Harvest
I try, yeah, hard. I mean, look, Justice might be the best song on the whole record.
Oh, man.
And so many top.
You know, yeah, exactly. Like, look, that's the thing with the record. There literally isn't a dud. You know, there's a dud in the first four albums. Like, in the first five albums, there isn't a dud, really. Like, as I said, I can live without Nothing Else Matters forever and ever and ever. But, like, there's still not a bad song. You know what I mean? So, but, like, Justice, Dyer's Eve.
I was just about to say, people need to give Dyer's Eve more of a chance.
The drums.
Oh. Everything. Like,
it's coming soon.
if you want to play that at any point, that is what means the most to me, is those guitar tones. And I've hunted for the Justice tone, and I've got EMGs in Explorers. They're not ESPs. I'm not that rich, but I've got, you know, I've gotten close, but no, nothing ever like that. In fact, we began this whole thing talking about that song I wrote, Eternal Night, and the idea of that was, can I approximate a Slayer song in 3 hours? That was the challenge I set myself. So my next one is, can I approximate an early Metallica song in 3 hours?
I'm looking forward to this.
Well, and the thing is, the challenge is, like, I'm not going to do it if it takes me 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, I've got too much stuff on. I've got, you know.
It's got to be fun too.
It's got to be fun. It's got to be a challenge. And the reason, so I used AI, I think, I don't know if you knew that, but I used AI for writing the lyrics of the song. And that was exactly that reason, that I got to a point where I was 2 hours and 20 minutes into recording. I was happy with the structure, happy with the riffs, happy with the playing. I had managed to botch program the Logic drummer Anders into making me into some kind of a drummer. And then I was like, oh God, lyrics. And I don't even know what a melody is. And I went, I haven't got time. And I went, ChatGPT, write me a Slayer song about an impending doom coming to finish us all. Boom. Perfect. Dude. Just go. So I think, like, from that point of view, you know, the Metallica one will be similar. I'll get to a point where, okay, this sounds like a couple of riffs that might be Metallica-ish. Now, ChatGPT, finish these lyrics for me because I ain't got nothing. You know what I mean? So, that's what I'm having fun doing, that kind of stuff. It's not, I'm not trying to release it, and I'm not trying to be.
It's a bit
of fun, and I love it, and it makes me happy. And people have been really complimentary, like, to see you playing the drums on it today. Another lad, when I put it out on Instagram, immediately did a guitar cover of it. I was like,
unbelievable.
This is literally unbelievable, like, what's happening. So, look, it's just a bit of crack, and why not? Like, you know, as I said, you know, if it was bad, I'd put it out with the same pride as if it was good. You know what I mean? Like, I'm just having fun doing it. So, so we'll see. The Metallica one will be coming soon. So,
I'm really looking forward to that. Yeah. That's going to be unreal.
Dave, thanks again for your time.
It's been a pleasure.
Really enjoyed it.
Thank you. Really enjoyed chatting to you. And yeah, if you want to get me back for another one, let me know. I'll happily do it again.
Definitely.
Thanks very much, Dave.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
See you later.
That's all for this week's episode of That Sound Podcast. I hope you enjoyed the episode with Dave as much as we did.
Yeah, what an episode. What a legend. Dave is a legend. What a couple of stories there.
Oh man, so many good stories.
I definitely think that's Kerry's guitar.
Yeah, no, I would be convinced.
Yeah.
Definitely, especially with all the talk between Jackson and ESP and as we talk the Seasons in the Abyss video. And
what about his mate breaking the guitar?
Oh man.
I'd cry. I'd kill him. I'd kill him first and cry. But what a legend got the part from, went into his office.
Yeah, no, that is absolutely
sent it over to
else.
Ireland, you know, Jesus. And then what about the Doctor Who?
Who would have thought that Corey Taylor was such a big Doctor Who fan, number one, but also played a cameo role?
Yeah, and his scream was in the episode.
And then the story after when they went to the Slipknot gig.
Oh, man. Bring your buzzer, bring your friends to work.
Yeah,
day,
motherfucker.
Oh, man, yes.
Absolutely incredible.
Yeah, Dave's a legend. Fair play to him. I really, really enjoyed that. I think you did too. Look, if you're enjoying our episodes, we'd really, really appreciate what helps us out massively is if you tell a friend about the podcast. You know, if you have time, maybe rate the podcast, leave a review. That really helps us get the word out. And yeah, spread the word.
Yeah, don't tell us anything we know already. Keep it to yourself.
Yeah. Only good news. No, seriously, we're loving it. We hope you're loving it. And yeah, stay tuned for more.
Stay tuned for more.